I am happy to be telling you about some of the work that's been done by the amazing team listed on the slide here, a couple of whom are in the front row up here with me. But in particularly, I'd like to point out Jeanette Senecal, who is the online education specialist who's made much of this training happen that I'm going to tell you about, and Dr. Carrie Bolton Etzel, who used to be at the University of New Mexico, is now in New Zealand, but who has been our MI expert, who you'll meet a bit later in the presentation. We're going to switch gears just a bit here and talk about a clinical problem that's addressed by providers in school-based health centers. And I think in the opening session yesterday, several of the speakers alluded to sort of the epidemic that we have with childhood obesity, and in particular, the health disparities that are evident with this problem amongst the youth that we serve. And you can see from the first bar here, that's children who meet the criteria for a diagnosis of overweight, and then the extended bar is how many of those children are obese. And when you look at Mexican American and non-Hispanic Black, you can see that we're nowhere near turning the tide on this epidemic. Although the national data, when you look at child obesity as a whole, shows that there's some leveling off. It's not leveling off for these children. We also know the health risks of being overweight or obese are that there are health problems that we used to see when I was first in nursing school back in, we won't say when. We never used to worry about children getting type 1 diabetes, or type 2, I'm sorry, or joint problems or high blood pressure. You never saw a diagnosis of hypertension in a school-aged child or adolescent, and now it happens every day in school-based health centers. We also know that the leading causes of death in adults in our country are related to lifestyle, and that heart attack, stroke, and cancer being the leading causes of death occur far more often in somebody with an overweight or obese problem, in addition to all the other adult problems listed there. And I applaud Dr. Shields' work because it's work like you're doing that makes it possible for us to look at school achievement. But some studies that have been conducted by Shore and colleagues looked at overweight kids and lower grade point average and lower physical fitness scores and more problems with detention and school attendance, tardiness, and less participation in athletics. This was a big study, several hundred kids in middle school age. So lots of expert panels and groups of clinicians have gotten together and made recommendations or guidelines on what to do about this. And fortunately, several members of my research team have been on these various panels. Dr. Lynn Gilbert and myself were part of NAPNAP's Healthy Eating and Activity Together. As a result of that work, I was invited to be part of the expert panel recommendations that HRSA, the Maternal Child Bureau, CDC, and the AMA pulled together. Dr. Gabe Scheibe, who's part of our team, was part of the Pediatric Metabolic Syndrome Working Group, and we have also reviewed the Bright Futures and the NHLBI guidelines. And there's consensus, fortunately, around all these expert groups on what we should be doing as primary care providers to address this childhood obesity. And some of those things are to record the child's BMI and BMI percentile, blood pressure percentile, and that clinicians should be using motivational interviewing to counsel families and children on healthy eating and activity. But when you look at the research, there's pretty much widespread failure of clinicians to implement guidelines on anything, no matter what we agree as experts we should be doing. When we look at how you pull that off in the clinical setting, it rarely happens. The other thing that we were told as we began to train clinicians in the across the country on what these recommendations were, they said, Bonnie, that's great, but we haven't been trained in using motivational interviewing, and we don't have time. So despite the recommendations for a long time now, since the first expert panel released guidelines in the late 90s, the recommendations have been for the BMI to be calculated and plotted in the child's chart. And chart audits in a variety of clinical settings reveal that maybe 5% of initial visits for children with a diagnosis of obesity actually have a BMI percentile. So it's hard to know how those clinicians were coming up with that diagnosis. I suspect eyeballing children who are severely obese picks up the children who need help, but probably misses a great deal. And we know that the national statistics you just saw were close to 50% in some ethnic groups. So obviously, if we're only getting a BMI on 5%, we're missing some. Dr. Cook's work in 2005 found less than 1% of well child visits documented a diagnosis of obesity. And saddest story of all, in my own faculty practice site, we conducted a chart audit of 191 well-child visits. It was about 20% of the population served by that school-based health center at that time. We found that most of the kids had a heightened weight in the chart, 20% had a BMI documented, and 17% had a BMI percentile. So even the believers were not getting the work done. And the same was true with the blood pressure. And you can see, sadly, the blood pressure percentile for age was only documented 1% of the time. How many people in the audience are actually clinicians that know how complicated this is? So, you know, to get a blood pressure is pretty easy. To put it in the chart is pretty easy. But in order to get a blood pressure percentile, you have to look at the kid's height, gender, and age, and use a chart. And so it takes a few extra steps. So that's the excuse I'm providing for why it's not there. So the specific aims of this particular study were, or the parent study, is a comparative effectiveness trial that has been funded by AHRQ to evaluate the effectiveness of web-based training with and without some technology support for clinicians on both providers' process and outcome behaviors related to implementing the guidelines in their school-based health centers. And then second of all, we wanted to explore the role of health information technology in the process of system change for implementing the guidelines in these settings. And specifically down the road, we plan to conduct focus groups to look at what were the facilitators' barriers and the impact of the chronic care model on change. But today, I'm going to tell you the purpose of this presentation is just to describe the first part of the study, the provider satisfaction with our web-based motivational interviewing training. We have enrolled 24 practice sites in 6 states and have clinicians who have conducted baseline data at each of those sites and have participated in the training. And the training was based on the Health Disparities Collaborative approach. Are people familiar with the Health Disparities Collaboratives? They've been conducted on asthma, depression, diabetes. No? So HRSA back a while ago, maybe 15 to 20 years ago, came up with this Health Disparities Collaborative approach to educating clinicians on better ways to approach health disparities. And the initial plan was flying clinicians from community health centers and school-based health centers to Washington, giving them intense training over a couple of days, sending them back to their setting and having them implement those guidelines and collect data, monitoring data at their site on how they were doing with implementing the guidelines. And then quarterly, they'd be flown back to Washington once again, give another dose of intensive training back to their site, implement, and it was these 4 quarterly learning sessions, and then this training these providers on the quality improvement and the process of data collection. that help to improve the practice at the sites. So we had participated in that type of training and found it to be really, really helpful in improving our asthma care. So we decided to approach or adopt that approach for this particular project. The difference is it's very, very expensive to fly clinicians from all over the country to any one site for the intensive training. So we adopted the web-based training for our approach to this project. The four learning sessions are spread out over a year. Learning session one was an overview of the recommendations and guidelines with an introduction to motivational interviewing. Learning session two was advanced MI. Learning session three was on culturally sensitive care and community collaboration, and we partnered with NICHQ, the National Initiative of Child Health Quality, to use their child advocacy module for that. And learning session four is for the individual sites to create e-posters that they'll share with each other on lessons learned and what progress they made in their site. So the technology approach we adopted was really something that needed to be accessible, transparent, usable, and cost-effective, and also tap the expertise we had available. So we came up with the idea of a learning community that was web-based, and it was housed on a social network site called Ning. And the advantages to Ning were that that it was a social network site that was accessible, scalable, could be housed on our computer technology that we had available. I was at Arizona State University at that time, and it was flexible and familiar to some partners or some of the research partners team, is what I'm trying to say. The training modules that we created, we used Adobe Presenter, and we had these experts, clinical experts, who were part of making up these expert recommendations and guidelines, were then available to these clinicians across the country through a voiced PowerPoint, and were accessible to the clinician on their own time frame whenever they had time to review the material. So it was available, flexible, familiar, and had a variety of presentation modules available. We also added to that some training videos, because as we began to do the training on motivational interviewing, it became very clear that these clinicians needed some examples so they could see what we were talking about. So embedded in some of these voiced PowerPoints are some specific examples demonstrating the principles of MI, and here's one I'd like to share with you.
So what specific change for you was the big motivator for you to make a drastic lifestyle change?
Well, you know, and not in and then thinking everything that goes wrong with your body, you're sick. But it's your weight. And you know, not being able to do the simple things, the easy things, tying your shoe, bathing, getting out of breath, just getting out of bed, not being able to roll over in the bed. When you're overweight, you have so many challenges that you're disabled to basically die.
So for those of you who aren't familiar with motivational interviewing, the idea with motivational interviewing is the clinician says less and just tries to elicit from the patient and family reasons why they want to change. And she demonstrated for us lots of reasons there. Then the third piece of this training was this continual contact with the research team and the clinical experts. And we conducted webinars and conference calls. Originally, we had planned to do all webinars so they could see us and we could see them. But unfortunately, school-based health centers don't all have the level of technology that was required to conduct the webinar successfully. And so we shifted to the lower tech conference call and have maintained really good contact with our sites doing monthly calls. So what I'm going to report on now real quickly is just a descriptive survey regarding the satisfaction with motivational interviewing that was administered at the completion of each one of these online multimedia modules. And our analysis plan was just descriptive statistics. And here's the sample. Our mean age, you can see, is about 45. Most of our clinicians are female. The majority are Caucasian. About a third are bilingual. And overall, they were very satisfied with the training on the intro to MI. This was on a 1-4 Likert scale. I don't know if you can read the tiny print across the bottom, but basically they were very satisfied with the objectives being met, the speakers being interesting, the information was useful, the speaker was knowledgeable, useful AB, and an average of the items. This one was an example of what happened in the advanced MI.
Okay, so we just talked about the stages of change, and we specifically talked about people who are not interested in changing, those who are ambivalent about changing, and those who are committed to changing. So how do we figure out where people fall on the spectrum? Are people ambivalent? Are they not interested? One of the things that we do in terms of motivational interviewing is we assess readiness, confidence, and importance to change on a scale of 0 to 10. So what we're going to do now is we're going to do a brief little exercise to assess your readiness to change, the people here in this room. So my question for you is, think about yourself and your level of physical activity. And my question to you is first going to be about importance. How important is it for you to increase your physical activity? And there's a scale here on the wall from 0 to 10, 0 being absolutely not at all important, 10 being absolutely important. How important is it for you to increase your physical activity? So I'm going to ask you just to move around the room and stand below the number that you feel matches where you're at. Where you're at right now. Okay, so two of you are 7-ish and then two up maybe 10-ish. Is there anyone who's willing to tell me why you picked the number that you picked? Okay, Yolanda, thanks. Okay.
So you can see that we were a little bit worried about that. It's usually designed to be a very interactive action sort of part of the training module, and doing it online, we weren't ready. We weren't really sure how the participants would perceive it. But as you can see, they felt that that approach was also a good approach. And so for advancing MI, assessing readiness, the scores were very high. For values identification, the scores were very high. And for implementing MI, the scores were very high. And the total combined scores, they were just very satisfied. So the qualitative piece data that they provided is that the providers plan to incorporate the motivational interviewing into their visits, change the way they discuss behavior change, and they gave us specific examples of how they would do that, and use the MI tools when counseling patients. We are in the process now of collecting post-training data, looking at the chart audits and the patient satisfaction, and also the provider knowledge, behaviors, and barriers. And we'll know whether or not the training, we know they're satisfied with the training, but we don't know if it is going to change their practice. But soon we will. And we know that the providers reported high satisfaction with the web-based training on MI and strategies for using it. We're hoping it also changed their practice. And I'm happy to entertain any questions that you may have.
Just to say, this was terrific. How do you differentiate that between what they really think is true?
That's a really good question. I think it's the same with patient satisfaction surveys. Everybody says we're all doing great, but then they don't really follow through with the behavior change. So I think it's critically important that we follow up to look at did their behavior change, and did their patients perceive that they were getting the support they should have gotten from the motivational interviewing? And that's the data collection that's rolling in right now. But very good question. Yeah. It's actually a national study that we're currently conducting. So we are currently training providers in Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, North Carolina, New York, and Michigan. And so it's sort of a nationally representative study. Certainly willing to share with others as we finish up the study, but that'll be about a year and a half from now. But happy to share. I will just mention a few of the limitations, which I didn't mention. We have had a variable provider engagement in the training, and that's a challenge always. I think that will influence how they implement it in the various sites. And we didn't really collect data on whether or not these providers had previous experience with MI, and that may also be a bit of a confounder. It's also going to be hard to see improvement in satisfaction pre to post because the satisfaction was so high pre, but we're hoping their behavior will change. Thank you.